Blog Talk Radio.
Sidekick Publications is the newest place for all your martial arts informational needs. My Karate, Introduction to American Wadaru, Martial Arts Guide to Success, History of Japanese Martial Arts, Taizanru Taiho Jitsu, and the new Martial Directory. With martial art master instructors like Michael DePasquale Jr., Joe Miller, Alan Woodman, and many more. Everything for martial arts enthusiasts, techniques, shiatsu, history, all in one place. Available at Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble's, and bookstores near you. Also available on digital downloads for Kindle and ebook readers. Visit our website at www.sidekickpublication.com and order your books today. Remember, Sidekick Publications, all the action you can read.
Welcome to the program, everybody. Martial Arts Talk Radio. I'm your host, Danny Venna. Today is, it's going to be a good day, I can tell. Last night we had a wonderful show. We had some great people call in. The topic, if you look on my Facebook page, Sifu Restita de Jesus said that she would have called in, but she didn't have a headset. And I guess she was traveling, but she left us a little note saying that it was a great topic and that who knows, maybe she'll call in tonight if she's listening. We have our co-host on the phone. This is Greg Molina. Say hello, Sensei.
Yes, hello. How are you tonight?
Well, we're doing well. We got a couple of things that we want to say real quick. Our first shout-out, of course, goes to Sidekick Talk Radio with Shihan Alan Woodman, the host, and Renchi Timmy Frisk, the co-host. Their show airs on Sidekick Talk Radio every Wednesday at 12 noon, every Sunday at 6 p.m. And to speak to the host, you can dial 347-237-4818. Our next shout-out goes to Sifu Alan Goldberg with Action Power Hour radio show on Tuesday night at 7 p.m. And to speak to the host, Sifu Alan Goldberg, you can dial 713-955-0323. So let's pick up where we left off last night, Sensei, because we got some wonderful response about cross-training. Obviously, you have, over the last, 10 years now, been involved with Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. Is that right?
Yes.
How do you feel about that experience? Obviously, when you started training in the Ishinru system, you attained the rank of black belt. And now, as I understand it, you're getting very close to becoming a black belt in that system as well. No easy task. So tell us, share with the audience your experience when it comes to cross-training.
Having starting with you in 1998, just a great, experience, garage dojo, the one-on-one type of training is something that I'll never forget. No boundaries, no restrictions, no barriers, just pure teacher-student relationship, feeding off of each other, teaching me, absorbing the information. And, going to Sensei Black's dojo and having those epic sparring sessions, with all the students over there, really just, and training 6 to 7 days a week with you in that environment, really got me just good really fast and just, had a great respect for everything that was going around and what I was learning. That ultimately is what led me to the pursuit of learning other things because of our relationship and how open it was and, how quick we could decipher techniques, and just pick them apart and learn. That right there was ultimately leading to my wanting to search for other knowledge. And obviously, you know, with the go-ahead from you, that was the big key right there. You know, having achieved brown belt in Ishinru when I first started my Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu studies, I think shows right there. You know, I wasn't a white belt when I pursued another art. You know, I had interest in other things and did some research, but I put my head down with the Ishinru, as you know, and it was something that we did, you know, just effortlessly and just without even thinking about it. You know, we just dove into it. And you know, you definitely recommended, yeah, you know, check these guys out. These guys are great. And we actually had our classes in the Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu dojo, Kyoto Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, when it was on Sunrise Highway over there. You know, Sensei and McGrath had rented that space, and we were in there. So that environment promoted cross training right there, you know?
Sure.
And so that just started that. I mean, like I said last night, doing the Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu only led to much more appreciation for the Ishinru, because I learned what the Gracie family had did when they learned the Japanese style of both judo and jiu-jitsu, you know, since judo is ultimately streamlined techniques from jiu-jitsu. And, you know, what happened was the Count Koma, the guy who brought judo or his form of judo and jiu-jitsu to Brazil, basically refined the arts that he learned and basically did the same thing Tachiro Shimabuku did. You know, he was very frowned upon because back when judo was becoming popular, they sort of were just concentrating on the throws, and there was a school called the Fusenru that basically challenged the judo competitors and beat them on the ground, which then led to Jigoro Kano opening the rules a little bit of judo to allow for the different submissions to take place, as I believe the history goes. I also believe that there's a story that President Roosevelt got a demonstration of judo from some of Kano's top men, one of them including Count Koma, the guy ultimately training the Gracie family. And what happened was, because of the politics of martial arts, which we talked about on this show, basically, and this was told by Henzo Gracie, by the way, is President Roosevelt got a demonstration, and then he wanted an American wrestler to challenge the instructor that did the demonstration. Now, it so happened to be that Koma was outranked by this older, out-of-shape instructor, but because he was a higher rank, the Americans figured, well, we want to fight the higher rank guy, not knowing that Koma was the other guy that he should have fought, because then the Japanese guy would have won. And what happened was the wrestler took the judo guy down and basically just held him down there and stalled on the fight, and it turned out that the Americans declared the American wrestler the winner, and then Koma got upset, and then he went to Brazil and wound up teaching the Gracies. Now, if Count Koma would have done and won that fight, and, you know, against that American wrestler, Koma most likely would have stayed in the United States. That's a pretty amazing story right there. That's the story from Henzo Gracie's documentary called Legacy. Pretty interesting fact that I'm sure not a lot of people know. That's just a little history on that. You know, back to my Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu experience, that's just, you know, the fact of us being in that dojo helped with my cross training. And just like, you know, all the things I was learning, we were learning too, because I would learn them and me and you would go over them and see how that would help us as martial artists. You know, we didn't shun it. You know, like we said last night, if anything, it only made my Ishinru better, because I could avoid and, you know, defend any ground attacks. You know, I think that's the biggest point people don't realize is, when you say, oh, we don't need to learn that, you don't want to go on the ground on the street. of course we don't. I definitely would like to avoid that, and the way to avoid that is to become an expert in that realm that you don't want to be in, you know, as the best way to put it. I mean, that experience that I have, and I'm still practicing the Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu today as well, it's definitely an art that made me realize that you have to have a live training environment. And it's something that learning from you, Sensei, that's how we got, you know, to the point where we were getting good really fast, because we put an emphasis on the Jiu-Kumite after drilling the techniques, and we put them into action against the resisting opponent, you know, because I see a lot of martial arts these days just breaking down techniques. You know, for example, somebody throws a punch, you block. You return the punch. If they block that, then you go into something else. And once you start going that deep into breaking something down, you lose the sense of reality. You lose the sense of, you know, what you always said, a sense of urgency. You know, you don't have that realization of a real fight going on anymore, because you're breaking it down to the point where it's too slow. You know, it's not that what you're teaching is not going to happen in a real fight. And I think Ishin Ryu's Ippon Kumite reflects that, because that's still the techniques are thrown full speed. You know, you build up to that full speed point. You're not throwing slow motion anymore. You drill it in the beginning to learn the technique, but then that Ippon Kumite technique is thrown at full speed, so you're against a resisting opponent. You know, what do you think about that?
Well, it's absolutely the way we train. If I don't give you a real environment, 9 chances out of 10, when that punch on the street comes at you, you're not going to be ready for it, and you're going to make a mistake, and you're going to get hurt. So we try our best to build an environment where we give you as much stress as you can possibly deal with to set certain benchmarks so that they become flinch responses. Now, we have a 405 caller on the wire. Please introduce yourself.
Hey, Hachi, how are you? It's Daryl.
Grandmaster Sergeant again. I love it. He calls into our program, Greg. What a great supporter this guy is. I mean, I can't say enough about it. I mean, for you to take the time out of your day, Grandmaster, to be a part of the program and show your support, us, thank you very much.
Oh, no problem. I'm a junkie.
I love it. I love it. So what did you think of Greg's answer when he said that, you know, trying to have a set of instructors around you that are going to you into this, basically, I guess, fighting machine maybe might be a good way to describe it. You know, it's interesting to hear him say that Frank Black's dojo up in Smithtown, and then his students, dojo in Lindenhurst, Sensei Lee Snyder. Both of those locations were two places where we frequented because, number one, the dojo up in Smithtown used to like to do a lot of mixing it up. They were all men. A lot of them were police officers. And when Greg and I used to go up there, and, you know, whenever Sensei would come with us, we just had this wonderful exchange of, fighting. Yes, of course they did kata at that dojo, of course. It is part of the system. But the main ingredient in that dojo was fighting. So listening to Greg's response, Grandmaster, did you get a feel for how he experienced both working in the Ishin Ryu system and working in the Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu system?
I didn't hear all of it, but I mean, the ability to cross-train is always, I believe, a good thing. And I believe that it is important to be able to be knowledgeable about various aspects of the arts, whether it's ground, whether it's weaponry, whether it's striking. I believe that really, from my perspective, again, once you go deep into your art, you should be able to be knowledgeable that all those things are found in the arts, or in the arts, and that it's just basically the teacher and their depth of breadth of knowledge within the katas or within that system that hopefully will be able to manifest that and bring that out.
So over the years, Grandmaster, you how do you feel about the practice of kata? How do you feel about the effectiveness of how it affects your how you do your karate, how you deploy your now you have a wealth of knowledge when it comes to cross training. I'm just looking at the information that you sent me the other day. How does it actually affect your performance? Now I'm referring to kata and the structure of kata. How do you think it has affected your performance when it comes to jukumite, you know, fighting?
As far as jukumite, I don't really express too much of the kata within that. The jukumite will come in when it comes into the practicality of the self-defense, the principles of the art, and the concepts that are found within the katas. Each of the founders of these katas had a unique entity that they implemented into the kata. And once you go deep into your kata, you should be able to express what really the true nature of the kata is in accordance to the type of art form that you do. But for me, I really didn't even start really learning the breadth of knowledge of the katas really until I left karate and was into more of the silat and the kumpao. That is where I started learning really how to bring forth the applications of the katas. Unfortunately, before that time, there wasn't a lot of the bunkai really, really taught in depth. And also because of my jiu-jitsu background, I was able to extrapolate a lot of what was seen in the katas through the principles and concepts.
Interesting. And how about you, Sensei Malia? Did you get anything worthwhile in your performance based on the katas that we've practiced over the years? Do you feel that that is lend a hand, or has it enhanced your performance? Do you give it any kudos? Like, let's say that, yes, I got certain things out of the katas that I do use when I do my jukumite.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely see the benefit to kata. I think some people kind of, if they don't really understand what kata is, they will kind of just, you know, not want to focus on that and just fight all the time. But I think that's the wrong approach because, you know, for me, the kata emphasized the karate technique. You know, very rare was it that I used a certain combination of techniques in a kata and particularly used that in a jukumite session. I definitely see a lot of self-defense application in the katas, without a doubt. It can give you a lot of knowledge of what can be done in a self-defense situation. But I think what kata more so is to keep your technique sharp when you're by yourself, you know. When you're teaching a new student, it's the kata is where the foundation is. It's where, you know, the style is embodied, especially in the higher up katas when the founders put their own flavor in it. You know, I think you got to understand the goal with kata. Obviously, there's hidden techniques and there's all different applications, but I think a lot of people take it, you know, out of context where, oh, you have to use these certain string of techniques you learned in the kata in your fighting, and I just think that's not enough knowledge in the student to really understand what kata is about But I definitely see a huge benefit to kata, without a doubt.
And now my next question is for Grandmaster Daryl Sargent. In your Jukumite sessions, when you work out, let's say, with some of your higher ranks, obviously when you work out with, you know, the people that are new into the style, you have to ease them in. But as you have students of rank around you and you are using the Jukumite sessions to maybe practice something that you like, maybe get a little bit better at a piece of timing or whatever it may be, tell us, Grandmaster Daryl Sargent, is there something that you favor when you're working with some of your higher ranks?
Predominantly conditioning and then combination training, learning to maintaining that they can put all the techniques in combination. A lot of times when we look at the sparring, we see like maybe one, maybe two techniques, but literally not three, four, five things coming out one right after the other in a cohesive form. So when we focus on it, it's conditioning, it's combinations, and it's working on our defense, on our blocking system. Being, you know, I usually put guys on the wall, and I make them work their blocking system from the wall, learning how to slip movements, bob and weaves, all the type of looser type fighting, but all those things we implement in.
And talk to me about joint locks and submissions. Do you work on any of those in your Ippon Kumite session or in your Jukumite session?
Once I feel that a person is knowledgeable enough where they're not going to really get hurt and they know when to, when I know that they have the control to be able to put somebody in those levers and holds, then that's fine. I just, you know, for me, jiu-jitsu is not a sport, so I try not to do that in a sport type realm. But yes, in the midst of kumite, somebody shoots off and can get off that throw, that shoulder throw, that hip throw, and then they can go right down into the ground aspect and then right back up. And that's all part of the equation. That should all be inclusive in the system.
Now I have a question for Melita Sensei, and that is, one of the links that I keep blasting out is that flying armbar that you do. I use it as a showcase to some of the people, you know, that I'm talking to, whether it be here in the States or overseas. So I'm constantly cutting and pasting that flying armbar technique that you have on the YouTube channel. Tell us about that, Sensei Melita. Tell us how you set that up.
Sure. Originally, that one was that was in 2005 at the U.S. Open of Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, and I also have another clip of one in 2008 at the Purple Belt Championship there. And definitely, you know, make that distinction clear right away. That was, you know, sport jiu-jitsu on a mat. And obviously, you know, I don't advocate throwing a flying armbar in a street situation. But I think that's a big point to cover is, you know, the mindset. Nobody in a sport jiu-jitsu match is claiming they're going to do a lot of those techniques in the street. You know, a lot of people, will look down upon that. But it's just to be able to do that technique. Now, going back to that particular technique, you know, in that one clip, it happened to be the open weight category in that division. So the guy I was going up against was like at least 30, 40 pounds heavier, and it's a tournament matchup. So, you know you're going to have anywhere from 2 to 6 fights within 20 minutes. So, right. You know, you want to conserve. So that first fight, I knew I wanted to end it quick. And right out of the gate, he was stiff-arming me with the lapel grip. From the stand-up position, and all I did was shoved one way, got him thinking, and got him off balance in the one direction towards my left, and then I jumped into the flying armbar, keeping the grips, throwing the leg over the head in a circular motion to not have the impact on the floor be as hard. And as soon as you land on the floor, the leg is over the head and you lock out the submission. Fight was over. You know, felt great to pull that off in a full resisting live match, you know, without a doubt. But that particular technique is on YouTube. I'm sure since Edmund has that on his Facebook there, like he said. And I'd like to go into that view a little bit, that mindset. A lot of people don't train specific environments because they say that it's not realistic. But I'd like to point out the point of, you know, when you're training jiu-jitsu, say I'm in the mount position of somebody, you know, or you're drilling a technique, somebody might say, oh, well, that guy can just punch you right from there. And he very well may be able to, but the point is you're learning the body mechanics in that position. Just because somebody can punch you from there doesn't mean you shouldn't train it. You know what I mean? Like, I think that's the old way of looking at things is, oh, well, we don't want to work that position because the guy can most likely do this to you. You know, it doesn't mean you shouldn't train that position. And I relate that to what Kyokushin does. A lot of people, even myself, when I first saw it, I said, oh, that's stupid, because in their tournaments, you're not allowed to punch to the face. So to somebody like a karateka, they're going to look at that and say, wow, that is unrealistic. There's going to be a lot of bad habits formed. But I've recently changed my opinion on that because these guys have a great feel for fighting full contact, no padding, at that range, that close-up range, and they're able to throw these high kicks from really close. And if you see a lot of the K1 kickboxers that have come from the Kyokushin background, then they just adapt and they get their hands ready and they train their boxing skills, and then they're ready to go. But people frown upon certain types of things, and they say, oh, how can you train just punching to the stomach and utilizing high kicks when you're not allowed to punch to the face? You know, when you get into the street, your hands are going to come down. And I believe in training in different ranges of combat. And I think that's something to be said, you know.
Now, let's just stick to that point for a second, ranges of combat. Grandmaster Sergeant, would you say that now, at this point in your martial arts journey, would you consider yourself an inside fighter or an outside fighter, or both?
Dr. Moses Powell called it elevator fighting. So in New York, the elevators were very, very small. And so a lot of times what we used to do was to bring whoever we dealing with in the elevator, and between floors we would stop the elevator. Neither one of us could get out. And we take care of business, and whoever was still awake at the end, we go ahead and then, you know, we get off at the next floor. So for me, I am one who is more in close than I am outside. At an earlier stage when I used to use a lot of leg techniques, then I was a little bit more outside too. But now at the age and stage where I am, I'm more medium to inside.
Oh, thank you so much for sharing that with us, Grandmaster. That's so important. Now, let me turn that over to Sensei Greg. Let's ask Sensei what he feels now. Would you say that you are an inside fighter or an outside fighter, or both, Sensei Greg?
It really depends on the situation. You're obviously talking a street situation. I would think, Sensei, you're talking a street self-defense type of aspect.
Okay, let's go with that. Yes, yes.
Okay. It depends on the environment. It depends on the opponent. It depends on my surroundings. You know what I mean? If I got a guy in a self-defense situation that's going to come after me, and he's 250 pounds, even with my Ishimu background, I don't have the desire to stand toe-to-toe with this guy. So I'd be an inside fighter at that point, you know. If I got a guy that I believe is drunk and he's coming at me swinging, I'll just take him down and control him. It depends on my surroundings. I'm not going to hurt the guy, you know. If I got multiple attackers, that's different. You know, if I got somebody that I got to employ my Ishinru and then throw a sidekick right to the midsection to to drop them quick so I can escape, I'll do that. So, I mean, training in all the ranges of combat, I'm comfortable to see what I can receive and what that opponent's going to give me in order for me to respond and attack. And obviously there's going to be situations where you have to attack first, and that's just based on, like I said, the situation as well.
What an awesome show tonight. That's our half hour. Unfortunately, it goes so fast. But that's why I do it every night, because I get 30 minutes. When I get, you know, callers like both of you on the wire, and I can ask questions like that. And then the answers and the responses that I get, what I do is I use that now. I will use this as an example. I will play this episode as an example to some of the students and let them listen to what your experience has taught you. So at least then, as they're practicing, they'll remember, okay, well, he did say when I'm in an elevator, I'm in a very tight space, which means I have to fight on the inside. Based on the situation, whether I have to just control my attacker or I have to do away with my attacker will determine whether I'm on the inside or the outside. So, you know, for children to hear something like that from experienced martial artists like yourself, it's an invaluable resource, fellas, because these kids are, they have no good habits, they have no bad habits. They don't have any habits right now. Some of the children that I teach are brand new into the martial arts. They ask a lot of questions. They don't know why we're doing some of the things that we're doing. It doesn't make sense to them just now. But eventually, as they come back and they continue to train, I'm hoping that my instruction will give them what they need to sustain themselves should they ever encounter a self-defense situation on the street. And then, of course, when they're in the dojo, when they're working on certain drills, which is what you mentioned, Grandmaster Daryl Sergeant, working on certain drills. These are some of the benchmarks that we set by playing these little segments for them, let them listen to it, and then take some of the instruction that they're getting during the class, apply it to a practical base, which means we try to raise the level of stress in each one of the students to sort of scare them a little bit, because that's how you set benchmarks in your brain. So again, I mean, it's just an invaluable resource. I cannot even put a price on just how valuable having both of you explain to the younger students your concepts, your principles, your ways, your means, your methods. And then again, when we mention names like Dr. Moses Powell on the program, it fills my heart, because that means that his teachings, as long as we are alive and doing this type of work, will never go unnoticed. They will always be reminded to the new guys and the new students coming into the system that these were his teachings. This is what he spilled onto us by saying, well, go into an elevator. Stop it in mid-floor. And who's ever standing when it gets to the next floor wins, you know. And that is something that, you know, the kids will probably laugh at. And they'll ask me, well, explain that to me. Show me. So I'll have one of them stand up and we'll operate within this little small space. And that we'll try to simulate fighting in an elevator. I like what you said about having the students line up with their backs against the wall, because now they can't retreat, and now they have to deal with whichever way the attack is coming, whether it's a frontal attack or a side attack. Because they can't go backwards now, they are forced to use their technique to be able to misdirect whatever is coming into their circle, and then you know, defend against it and hopefully put some type of finishing move onto it to make sure that they are either subduing their attacker or finishing their attacker. So, again, thank you very much for calling in tonight. It was a wonderful conversation about a specific area of what we deal with as instructors, because I don't like fighters that have to retreat. I would rather have you, if not stand your ground, then, you know, go into that circle and do your damage. One of our precepts is that strike when the opportunity presents itself. Sometimes you have to make the opportunity. If you noticed in Sensei Greg's description of when he went to deploy that flying armbar, he used a little bit of deception, making the guy think he wanted to go right when he really wanted to go left, and then, of course, did his technique. And I believe that fight lasts, what, about 19 or 20 seconds? So
yeah, it was right off the bat there.
I understand. You know, you said that there were going to be several fights that day, and you wanted to save some gas. So you wanted to win that one right away. That's, you know, that's just good thinking strategy. And I will say this on the program, that out of the students that I've trained over the years, you know, Melina Sensei just has this innate ability to be able to make good decisions. Now, what that means is you take in information, you gather your facts, and you make good decisions. So that's a wonderful quality within, you know, that happens to be inherent in your design. Not everybody is like that. But, you know, hey, thank God you have that quality in you. Your timing, the way you deploy your techniques, you're a master at the art of deception. So I know that that makes my sensei very happy, because he was also very much, he was able to deceive you in a way that you took the bait, and when you took the bait, you know, that was his opportunity then to do what he wanted to do. So, you know, just as I said, I cannot say enough about these sessions that we're building, because each time we do it, little by little, as we build these sessions and we use them for what they're worth, they are like little training seminars. It's just an invaluable resource. It really is. And again, I will say this again, to be mentioning the names of our seniors almost on a daily basis keeps their teachings alive, keeps their name out there. We are promoting the teachings of our seniors almost on a daily basis. So, you know, to me, that's just that's a wonderful thing. Thank you.
No problem.
It's great to be on the show.
Well, then I'll tell you what we're going to do. We're going to do this right here. Just stay with me 1 second.
The Martial Arts History Museum is the first of its kind in the world, and it only exists with your support. Give generously to the museum and always listen to Sidekick Talk Radio.
We're going to be back tomorrow night. It will also be billed as open mic night. I like this format. I like the way it's working, because we can pick a topic when we have some of the experience that happens to be on the line right now to answer some of, or not answer, but to give us the flavor of what you, you know, what you would like to say about that specific topic. Seems to be flowing very well, so I'm going to stick with it. I'm going to stay with open mic night, and hopefully we'll see you guys back here tomorrow.
Great. Looking forward to it.
Good night.
Thank you very much for calling in. Arigato.
Arigato goes on, Miles.
And Sensei Melina, take care.